Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today, well, get on your overcoats and your boots and your long johns and whatever else, because we're traveling by mind to Antarctica. The book that we're going to be talking about today is one of the most beautiful books I've ever seen. The photography in it is just breathtaking. And Sebastian Copeland is my guest today. The book is called Antarctica, A Call to Action. Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Donna. It's an honor to be with you.
You are quite a guy. Not only are you a professional photographer, which I think your work is absolutely excellent, but you're an environmental activist, and you have been involved with photography, creating a message via that vehicle worldwide for a number of years, and you have ended up becoming involved in a seat on the board of directors for the U.S. branch of Mikhail Gorbachev's Green Cross International, as well as Shine On Sierra Leone. Now, you won the Professional Photographer of the Year award when you put out Antarctica, The Global Warming. And then, and that was done in 2007, you have just, and you've won awards for other things too. You have spoken to audiences at the United Nations, the World Affairs Council. You have been involved in so many, programs, anything that allows you to have the opportunity to be in front of people with what you become aware of. You're very conscious about the changes that are evolving. What is it that compels you to keep on this journey? You think after being on the board of directors and doing so many things that you'd be so occupied with that, who'd have the time to do photography? drives you?
Well, listen, thank you for all that those accolades and that that resume. What drives me is it's a conscientious choice, and it's in many ways it feels like a moral choice. As Al Gore eloquently put it, it is it's a generational mission that we have, and I'm driven by passion. It's one of these things, and I think passion is something that chooses you. It doesn't. Not something that you choose. You don't choose to be passionate. You don't choose to be an advocate necessarily. At least I didn't. You don't choose to be a photographer. Photographer chooses you. And I was fortunate enough that that sort of a synergy of my interest for advocating for the protection of our environment, and especially for advocating on behalf of humanity in general relative to the environment. And my photography came in concert and find a way to coexist and to promote that message. It sort of happened by accident. I was originally a portraitist and did a lot of celebrity portraiture in Hollywood and movie posters and things of that nature, which I still do occasionally. And in parallel to that, I had a sort of a more of an academic interest in science and climate science in particular, and it's something that I've been focused on for the better part of the last 12 years or so. And I joined Global Green USA, the organization whose board I'm on, about 10 years ago, and upon traveling the first time to the Arctic on behalf of the Inuit in 2005, I did a mission there to basically put a face to global warming. I discovered that platform. I was already a mountaineer and rock climber and whatnot, and I realized that actually there was just a great synergy in being able to travel to these places, which I did on my spare time for fun, and be able to photograph them and come back with a message from these exotic environments.
Your photography is just phenomenal. One of, I mean, it's just glorious, glorious beauty. Alaska has been like a second home to me for so many years.
Okay.
And I have a real passion for the far north. Myself, I can no more explain it than a man on the moon. Anybody that can enjoy an environment where you have 70 below zero, excuse me, or you're sane or insane. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, there is a beauty, there's a majesty with the far north, with that expression, and you have, right at the very front of your book, a profound photograph of a walrus calling, maybe to a mate, who knows. It could be a walrus that is, I think it's a walrus anyway, it's huge.
It's actually, it's a black fur seal, yeah.
Oh, it's a seal, okay.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a shadow, it's got its head back, its mouth open, and it's crying out. And who knows for what, but it's so poignant at the introduction of your book. And then you have the dedication where you say this is for future generations, and there were a whole group of you that on this piece of, humongous piece of ice, you put SOS.
Mm-hmm.
What prompted that?
Well, that actually was the impetus for my my first trip to Antarctica. I actually went down to Antarctica to realize this image as an advocacy image on behalf of Global Green, and I did this in concert with my good friend John Quigley, who is an aerial artist and who's implemented a variety of wide images around the world using people and positioning them on the ground to spell certain types of messages. And we'd worked together on that mission in the Arctic, actually, in 2005. And so in 2006, made sense to me to go back, to go to the Antarctica and duplicate to the south what we had done in the north. And, so these are the people there are the passenger and crew of the Ice Lady Patagonia, which is the science research ship, that I traveled on in Antarctica. And we positioned them on an iceberg in the Gerlache Strait in Antarctica on February 6, 2006. And they represent essentially 13 nations, you know, fortuitously so, because we just had, you know, a variety of different people, some scientists, some environmentalists, some of the crew from the ship itself as well. And together they represented this clarion to the world, you know, crying an SOS to pay attention to what is going on in the poles.
You have your cousin who wrote a wonderful commentary on sharing this journey with you. To get these photographs, it is so cold in Antarctica. What kinds of equipment did you use? How did you manage to position yourself? Because it's a very treacherous area to be in, and you were on this journey in a very Spartan environment with this 1950 Norwegian icebreaker.
Yeah. Well, that's a good topic, of course, Donna. Although I would have to say that, you know, traveling to Antarctica in its summer period, which is when I was down there on all my trips, is not as foreboding as all that. I've been in environments, particularly in the Arctic, at different times when it was a lot colder. In fact, I'm headed there in March and April to do a North Pole Peary Centennial expedition to the North Pole. And there the temperatures can drop down to, you know, minus 40, minus 50,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes even north of that, especially with the wind chill factor.
Oh, yeah.
But in Antarctica in the summer months, and that is part of the problem, the temperatures can actually be quite mild. They hover around zero, sometimes above zero, and that is in Celsius, so above freezing at times, between 5 degrees and minus 15 in Celsius, and that's really not that cold, particularly not when you find yourself in the realm of this icy realm where you'd expect such much frigid temperatures. Now, I would have to say that the peninsula, which is the leg that extends to South America from the northern tip of Antarctica, does see temperate weather. It's an environment that during the summer months is not pervious to seeing not impervious, that is, to seeing temperatures above freezing. The real problem, of course, is that it's those temperatures have been a lot higher and have come a lot earlier than in previous years. The peninsula specifically has been warming at a rate that is about 5 times the global average for the last 50 years, at a rate of about a degree Fahrenheit every decade. So, but to answer your question, the equipment, of course, you know, is exposed to some cold temperatures, and then especially a lot of wetness, and it was not unusual for my camera, especially when I was shooting from inflatable Zodiacs and getting to land, and we had quite a bit of rain at different times and whatnot. So equipment gets really drenched. But luckily, modern day, especially in the digital realm, I've switched to digital after a few trips down to the poles, because film is just very, very challenging, and digital actually delivers pretty good results at the very high end of the digital realm, of course. Very good results.
Yes, it does. Your photography, again, is just absolutely incredible. Will Steiger, S-T-E-G-E-R, who is he? And he talked about the Larsen shelf.
Mm-hmm. The Larsen B, Larsen A and Larsen B ice shelves are two of the shelves that are in the northeastern tip of the Antarctic continent, and near the not far from the peninsula. And these are, you know, these are critical glaciers that have been positioned there for literally, you know, in excess of 1,000, 1,500 years or so. And then before that, they most likely were, you know, bigger ones as well. So these have been very stable for that duration of time. And all of a sudden, we've seen in a period that has been really precipitated within the last decade or so, a fragmentation of these glaciers where, you know, with the phenomenon that perhaps some of your listeners are aware of, which is the moulins. And the moulins are these little holes that extend from the top of the glacier, the ice shelf, that is, in glaciers, moulins are a separate system, I'm sorry, moulins are for glaciers, and they lubricate the surface under which the glaciers sit, and then make them very fragile, you know, jeopardizing the structure, the integrity of the glaciers. But these ice shelves, are actually barriers to the interior glaciers, and so they all of a sudden, they see some fragmentations in them, and then all of a sudden they can collapse, as we've examined, especially with the Larsen. But there's also been the Ross ice shelf and a variety of different ice shelves that have just disintegrated in a very, very, very rapid fashion, and in such way that has confounded experts, and especially in the case of the Larsen B that collapsed in a matter of 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know there's been a lot of volcanic activity. There is the row of mountains, you might say, the circle of fire that the Pacific Northwest, Alaska, and, you know, other areas that are very close to, and there's been quite a bit of activity that's been going on. And so that generates a lot of heat under the water that generates something. Your photographs of these barrels that are up on an island area, or maybe on a glacier, it looks like it's a piece of landmass because of the rocks and then the old planks. Was this off of a ship that crashed?
No, actually, this is in a place called Port Foyne, which is in the Gerlache Strait. And Antarctica, at the turn of the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century, was a very vibrant whaling environment, and that was as a result of the decimation of the whaling population in the northern hemisphere, and particularly in the northern sea. The Norwegians, especially a guy called Sven Foyn, which inherited the name for that particular environment where you're describing, Foyn Harbor. Sven Foyn invented the exploding harpoon, and when they started outfitting those whaling ships with up to 30, 35 of those exploding harpoons per ship, they just went to town and just absolutely decimated the whaling population, and then set their sights onto Antarctica to find some more whales. And at the height of the whaling period in I think it was in 1929, they decimated over 30,000 blue whales in 1 year alone. And just to give you an idea, today there's less than 12,000 blue whales left in the world. So this was a an environment that was just vibrant with whaling ships and whatnot. So these are essentially it's human waste from about a century, barrels that were left over for and designed to carry whale oil from about the turn of the century. What is relevant about these barrels is that on my first trip to Antarctica, it's very difficult to capture climate change in photography, of course, unless you do specific scientific photography, which is, more boring, the photographing one glacier and coming back 10 years later and from the same position examining the recess. But in this particular instance, what was relevant about these barrels is that when I went there the first year, they were, some of them, first of all, they had been covered with ice for most of the century. Eventually, they got buried into ice, and they were buried. And then over the last decade or so, they started getting uncovered as the temperatures rose and the ice melted. But on my first trip there, the those barrels were filled with ice inside of them. So they, you know, they're 30 or 40-gallon barrels, so you certainly couldn't just lift them up. They were just too heavy. But on my last trip to Antarctica, the ice had melted to such an extent that many of those had been free of ice, and you could literally pick them up. And they were now, of course, exposed to decay and waste in that respect.
When you were in the area of Antarctica, did you experience any other environmental waste like these barrels in different places? Because it was an area that was rich with activity regardless of the bad weather that would come in there periodically. Did you find much floating around? Like, were there areas of plastic that were just floating in the water or anything of that nature?
You know, luckily, Antarctica sees very little tourist activity. I mean, it's not like there aren't any tourists. I think it sees about 10,000 tourists a year, so it's not negligible. But by virtue of the remote location, it's not a place that is visited by tourists on an autonomous basis, if you will. Most tourists who visit Antarctica come with on tourist ships, and these ships are very, very highly regulated as far as the protection of its footprint into the onto the Antarctic continent. And all of those tend to be eco-conscious. People who travel to Antarctica generally have a sensibility about protecting that environment, and certainly the tour organizers are very keen in adhering to the charters of protection and the protocols of protection for tourist boards. So, for instance, no, you cannot have more than 100 people make landfall from a ship in one particular location at the same time in order to preserve not to impact the environment too much and whatnot. So there's a strong onus placed on preserving and reducing the footprint of visitors in this region. And then for the rest, they tend to be just scientists. There's about, about 4,000 scientists who reside on Antarctica, and those, again, by virtue of their profession, tend to be very conscientious.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I know the waste and disposal of different things has to be done very carefully, because there it is so cold that there's not the breakdown. I mean, it takes a phenomenal amount of time.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, there are regions, there's areas where, once again, some of these, there's quote-unquote ports, which, of course, they're called ports only because there's, you know, a few steel moors that are left in the rocks that have been there for a century, and then some human waste in the form of, you know, either wooden barrels or different types of wood waste. But the bones of whales, for instance, that have that had been hunted and stripped in those times can literally stay there and remain there for, you know, for an excess of a century, and you find them easily in those regions. So as you say, anything that is being left over there is can be there forever. And in fact, you know, those tourist ships are quite good because they do a thorough cleaning of say feet, and people have to clean their feet before making landfall, so that they're trying very, very carefully to prevent the introduction of new and foreign organisms, which can sort of introduce a place like Antarctica, which has been really well preserved, bearing in mind that It's never seen a human footprint since, before 1821. So it's lived very much sheltered from the human footprint forever, and now the onus is to make sure that new foreign and antagonistic organisms don't find their way onto the continent.
David Roth, D. Rothschild.
Mm-hmm.
He put some information in your book. What is it about him that made the association so extraordinary that he's one of the spokespersons in your material?
Well, David, other than being a friend, David is a really very interesting, extraordinary young guy who, in spite of his family fortune, or perhaps thanks to it in some respects, has set his sight into really impacting the world with positive change, and especially by raising youth, especially youth, raising their awareness on issues that pertain to climate. So he has he's traveled to both Antarctica and to the North Pole as well, and has been very committed to messaging, essentially doing, we do similar things, David and I, and he's a good friend, and he's traveled both to the South Pole and to the North Pole, and has some insight that I thought was valuable to impart on people.
You have a political writer, Thomas Friedman, that you quote. He said, "Green is the new red, white, and blue."
Mm-hmm.
And I would be inclined to agree with it, and I think that globally there's more and more of an awareness that if we don't take care of the planet that we're on, we're going to poison ourselves. And Mother Nature will have a way of recuperating, but we may not if we don't get smart enough to do the things that are necessary. With these trips that you have made, with this absolutely phenomenal photography that you have done, part of the proceeds are going towards the continuation of education of people. Where are you going with your book? Where are you taking your information? Are you putting this into schools? I mean, what are you doing? How are you reaching out to people? Are you on a speaking tour?
Well, yes. I mean, it's a multiple. First of all, it's an ongoing process. The books are, as a photographer, the books are a way for me to output some of my travails and to be able to share some of the beauty of these exotic environments that I visit. And as far as my I'm a lecturer, and I do go and speak at various environments, and as well as that, I share that with children. I did a mission in the Arctic this summer, which was coined essentially the Young Ambassadors of the Arctic, under the banner of Pax Arctica, and I did this with a partner of mine, a guy called Luke Hardy, and in concert with Global Green, of course. And I took 9 kids from international backgrounds, one from Kenya, one from Italy, one from Germany, a couple from France, the U.S., an Inuit child, and basically took them to the sort of the far reaches of the northern Arctic, right up to Ellesmere and Ward Hunt Island, which is essentially the very edge of the northern continental Canadian Arctic, right before you find yourself on the frozen sea ice that leads you to the North Pole. And this was designed as an educational and interactive mission within this environment. So they met scientists and did homestay with Inuits, and then we camped and traveled and hiked into the Arctic. With the book, the book is it's the same thing. I bring this to a variety of different environments, sometimes with kids, and mainly it's true with adults, but it's only a function of time, trying to find the time in order to be able to share that with as many people as possible. So it is definitely a work of bringing this information and educating people through the beauty of images.
How have you been able to connect with the Inuits? I was watching a program last night about Amundsen and his tremendous interaction with the Inuits that enabled him to survive and to discover the passage that enabled other ships to follow.
The Northwest Passage.
The Northwest Passage. And in observing all of the things that he learned that nobody had taken the time to learn, of course, that radically changed the environment, the accomplishment that he created that it changed their life in many ways, and it's continuing to change. How is it that you were able to connect with them, and what have you found in your interactions with the Inuits to be most significant? Have they still been able to retain some of their culture, or has most of it disappeared?
That's a great question, Donna, and that is, in fact, I think at the at the epicenter of the issue of who is the first victim to climate change. And there's no question that the first victims to climate change tend to be indigenous populations, and especially the Inuit or the Upik or the, all of the very different indigenous population who exist and have lived in the high Arctic for thousands of years. And they went literally from the Ice Age to the Space Age in a matter of about 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
50 years ago, they lived mainly in igloos and had no contact of telecommunications and technology from the West, or from at least the industrial nations, that is. And then all of a sudden, they were introduced to all kinds of technological, quote-unquote, advancements, which really placed in jeopardy what was a holistic and sustainable culture. And now they find themselves much like much like other indigenous population, like the American Indians and the North American populations, in the sense that their culture is being lost, not just by the introduction of Western sensibilities or industrial sensibilities in the environment, but primarily because the ice is receding. And they hunt on the ice. They're
mm-hmm.
still very much a hunting culture. And as the hunt is receding farther and farther north, so goes their ability to survive from the hunt. And they become more and more reliant and the introduction of new products and new ways of life and whatnot. So their culture is literally endangered. And there is an extraordinary woman by the name of by the name of Sheila Watt-Cloutier, who is the international chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, the IPCC, different IPCC, but not the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, but it's the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. And she advocates on behalf of preserving the identity and trying to raise the message of how climate change is impacting the culture of the indigenous population of the Arctic.
I think it's inevitable that they are going to be impacted. I just think that it's a part of the world that we are in, and if there are those that are able to record and to get information, as some Canadian researchers have been able to do relative to the culture, but often the research comes about because of old diaries that people have kept talking about a lifestyle. But it's true. It really is changing, and in the 50 years that Alaska has been a state, the changes have just been absolutely astronomical on so many, many levels.
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, just as a statistic, I'll give you that one. It's other than the fact that the last 5 years have seen the greatest consecutive ice drop in Antarctica and the greatest loss of ice in Greenland, which doubled essentially between 1996 and 2005. But in 1989... the Arctic frozen ice cap was made of virtually 80% of multi-year ice, that is ice that was at least 10 years old. And today, this is 20 years later, only 3% of the Arctic sea ice is comprised of multi-year ice, meaning that 97% of the ice actually at some level at one time or another within the cycle of the that 1 year, or at least inside of 10 years, melts and freezes again. So this has a lot of consequences in terms of the structural integrity of the ice cap, and it also tells you that we went in 20 years from 80% multi-year ice to 3% multi-year ice.
It's an amazing world that we live in, and Mother Nature, in one way or another, does her own corrections. But we as human beings do have a responsibility, and I think worldwide that awareness is coming more and more to the forefront. And your book, Antarctica, A Call to Action is a fabulous publication, and I'm so pleased you were able to join me today. Do you have a website that people can go to? If there's teachers listening, they can find out about what you do and things that you've offered with students. I think it's marvelous. What's your website?
Yeah, the website is AntarcticaBook.com. So it's Antarctica. There's a C in the middle, which is why I insisted phonetically. Of course, it's pronounced Antarctica, but it's AntarcticaBook.com. So if you can go to that website, you'll certainly see some information about the book, some images, little films, and then some schedules of events and gallery shows and all the rest of that.
Well, Sebastian, it's been a delight. Again, AntarcticaBook.com is the website. It is breathtakingly gorgeous. This book is A Call to Action. Sebastian, thank you for doing what you do and being with us today. I so appreciate it.
You're very kind, Donna. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It has been a pleasure. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be taking a break. Don't go anywhere. We've got more good things to share with you. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me. Join us at the 7th Annual Conscious Life Expo, Conference, and Film Festival, February 13th through 16th at the LAX Hilton, 5711 West Century Boulevard, Los Angeles. We are bringing together cutting-edge speakers including David Icke, Sonia Hoquette, celebrity and musician David Carradine, Danyon Brinkley, George Norrie, Sean David Morton, Vashali, and many more. Visit www.consciouslifeexpo.com. or call the box office 800-367-5777 for discounted tickets.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and telephone lines are now open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. If you're a first-time listener, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. That's all. And then let me tell you what I perceive. And after that, you're welcome to ask a question about anything you like. Here are the toll-free numbers you can call in to, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians and U.S. can call in at 888-815-9756. So those lines are available for you, and you can give me a buzz, and I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Quick like a bunny, I want to follow up your hearing throughout the hour, the information about the Conscious Life Expo. Well, that's happening the 13th, 14th, and 15th of February. I am going to be there. I will have a booth, 537. Come on by, say hello. It's down in Los Angeles. It's a wonderful time of the year. And this is going to be quite a big expo, so I'm looking forward to being there. And I'm going to be speaking at 7 o'clock in the evening on Friday the 13th, a perfect day to do that. I just don't have any concerns about the 13th at all. But I also want to let you know, those of you who are in the Tacoma, Washington area, Seattle, Western Washington, basically, there is a class that I'm going to be presenting on April 25th, which is a Saturday. So I'm starting to let you know that's coming up. We are putting all the details together slowly but surely. It's been a little wild and crazy here in the office, so because we've been dealing with some issues with our servers. So anyway, now it looks like we're sort of over the hump with that, and we're going to be clearing out all of the debris of irritation and work that we have not been able to do, so we're going to do that. But as soon as I am in a position to let you know, that is going to be information I'll be giving out to you so that you can put it on your calendar well in advance. And this is going to be a class, and I'll be serving lunch and all kinds of things. It's just going to be wonderful. We had such a good time last year, and it was such a positive class. People that participated just loved it. They said, would you do another one this year? So I said, yes, I will. So that is going to be coming up. Also, here in the Pacific Northwest, an absolutely awesome event, and that is the Seattle Northwest Women's Show. And this is an event I've participated in for a number of years. It is absolutely awesome. That is coming up the last weekend in March. And this is going to be phenomenal, as it always is. Dynamic people participating. I will have a booth there, as I always do, and I will be giving you more information as we get closer to that event. That's going to be in March as well. So there's a full calendar. The newsletter is posted up on my website, so you'll be able to go into my website. That's all there. You'll find all the information, and as soon as we are able to get everything consolidated with this new server that we have, then we're going to be sending out this month's newsletter to you. So if you're on the subscriber list, you will be getting your own copy, and that, of course, is via email. And if you'd like to be a person that receives a copy of the newsletter, then just send me an email. That's all you have to do. Send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. I will get it. I will post you to the subscriber list, and then you will get it directly. But otherwise, just go right on the website, because it's all posted, and it was posted in its normal, timely manner. And again, I apologize for the delay in getting things to you. I wanted to share a few thoughts with you. One is when I was talking with Sebastian, and I was listening to him talking about the Inuit, I thought I would share with you an experience that I had when I was flying from Fairbanks, Alaska into Anchorage. I had the opportunity to have as a companion or neighbor on the flight a man that owned a major clothing store up in Fairbanks, and we had the most wonderful conversation. He was a dog musher. Right at the moment, I don't remember his name. He absolutely loved this sport, and it's a very challenging sport. If ever you've listened to any information about the Iditarod, which is the representation of the race that was put on to get vaccine to Nome when there were so many children that were so very, very ill. So anyway, he participates in these various dog mushing events. And he said that through the years he had suffered injuries to his hands, and he said as he got older his body was very uncomfortable, and when you're managing 12 dogs or more in these races, it's quite challenging. You really are dealing with some horrific elements of cold and the issues of wind and all kinds of stuff. Well, being in the clothing business, he had all of the latest of whatever is cold weather clothing. He said he'd still freeze. He went out, his hands would hardly be able to function. He had had injuries to his hands, and he said, I'd be in so much pain, I could just barely manage the dogs, because sometimes you have wind chill factors of 70, 80 below zero. And it's a brutal, brutal environment, being in the far north and then doing these kinds of activities. So he said it was always a challenge for him. Well, he'd come back from one particular race and was in so much pain because of the cold and the harshness of what he had to do when he was participating in this sport. And a friend of his, after hearing him talk about what he was going through, he said, come on, we're going to go to an Eskimo village. And I honestly do not remember at this time what group of Eskimos it was. He said, I know a woman who can make you the clothes that will enable you to do your dog races, and you will find that you are going to be able to do it without a lot of pain. The cold won't get to you. He said, okay, I'm open for anything. Now, he goes to this village with his friend. His friend introduces him to an Eskimo woman who is quite elderly. He said he believed at the time she was in her 70s. And he said no one in this village of the younger generation were interested in learning anything from the elders. And he said, after what I experienced with them, it's really a sad thing. So he talked to this woman, and her English wasn't especially good, but they were able to communicate, and he told her the problems that he had with the cold. She said, oh, I'll fix you an outfit. You won't be cold. Come back in a little while. She told him the time to come back and pick up his outfit. So when he goes back to the village after allowing the time to help so she can make what she needs to make, he finds that she has made pants. She has made muckluks, which are the boots that go over your feet. She has made him a coat. And she's just got everything together. And she also made him a sleeping bag out of animal skins. And she told him, she said, you will never be cold again. Well, he had a dog race that was coming up. He got this in time for the race. He packed it all up, dressed himself in the garb she had made for him, and was doing just absolutely fabulously. And he said, to his amazement, when he tried to sleep in the sleeping bag of skins that she had made for him, he got so hot, he never used it. He'd just sleep in his clothes. He said, my body was generating so much heat. He said, I thought I was going to die. I got so warm in the sleeping bag. But the one thing that was still plaguing him was his hands. And he had mittens. You know, he had these big mittens that she had made for him out of skins. And they didn't work. He said it kept his hands somewhat warm, but he still had this terrible problem because of having these injuries from the past. So he went back to the village, and he thanked her for what she had made for him. He said it really made a difference. And he asked her, is there anything I can do because my hands get so cold and my hands are in so much pain? So she listened to what he had to say, and she said, give me some time, and just give me a couple of days, and I'll fix it so your hands never get cold again. So he said, all right. So he was able to come back within a very short period of time, as she requested, and she hands him these two strips of animal skin with the fur, and said, now, you wear these. And she had him put the strips around his wrist. And he said, what is this? She said, never mind. Just try them and see if they work. So next time he participated in an activity where he was out doing the dog sledding and was the musher, then he found his hands didn't get cold at all. Now, we're going to take a break for just a moment. When we come back, I'm going to tell you the rest of this story. And it's for real. This is what I was told by a man who... clothing is his business, cold weather clothing. And I'll tell you what was done and why this fur was so effective at keeping his hands warm when the gloves she had made for him didn't. This is Donna Siebel. We're going to take a break in just a moment. Hey, give me a buzz if you want to chat. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Interested in UFOs, the paranormal, predictions, prophecies, and psychics? Then join us along with David Icke, Sean David Morton, Jim Mars, Richard Hoagland, Danyon Brinkley, Sonia Coquette, and many more at the 7th Annual Conscious Life Expo and Film Festival, February 13th to 16th at the LAX Hilton. Call the box office at 1-800-367-5777 or visit ConsciousLifeExpo.com for more information and discounted tickets.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756. When this man went back to the village, because after he participated in this particular race, he found that his hands, because of these strips of material that this woman had made from an animal skin, she had refused to tell him what it was. She said, try it, see if it works. Well, it did work. And he's been an active musher, to the best of my knowledge, ever since. And he said he's never experienced cold again. Now, these strips of animal skin were made into wrist bands. And she had given him specific instructions. She had told him, you take these wristbands and you place them so that they're right at the base of the palm of your hand. And what they will do, you to put them on so that the fur is against the wrist. And what that does, it keeps the blood warm so that as the blood is circulating through your hand, it will never get cold. Wear your mittens that I've made for you and your clothing. You won't have a problem with cold again. He found that was true. But he was curious about something. After all, he had been one of these businesses where companies from around the United States that make cold weather clothing would contact him because he was up in the far north and ask him to do tests and to do things and try them out and all kinds of stuff. And he said, I have yet to find a man-made product that equals this fur. And he said, it was important to me to find out why it worked. Well, he discovered that the coat, the leggings, the mukluks, they were made from caribou fur. And he said, the caribou, the hair on the caribou is hollow, so it holds heat. And then he said, the wrist pieces were not made from the same fur. And he kept bugging her about it. She said, nope, you're a white man. Don't understand. She wasn't going to tell him. Well, after a lot of begging and pleading, finally she told him, and she was very afraid to tell him. She said, this is husky. He said, husky? She said, yes. Husky fur is just very much like that of the caribou. And she said, it's hollow. Now, stop and think of this. These are people that have lived in the far north for thousands and thousands of years. They have learned how to survive. I had this guest booked for Antarctica a long time ago. To be able to turn on the television last night to watch a program on the cable network about Amundsen, the Arctic explorer, and how he lived with the Inuit for a long time. If you have a chance to see it, you need to do it. It was so fascinating because he kept very careful diaries on what he experienced with them. And they had learned long time before about the value of animal skins keeping them warm. Well, many of us would think, well, what about bear? What about seal? Well, the construction of the hairs, they and the Eskimos, long before science came around as we know it today, they knew what worked. Now, seal skin, the innards of the seal, were often used to make what they would call their water parkas. That's a modern term I'll use. But they would wear it because it lasted a long time. And you will find in many antique stores that there are those people that will carry these very special outfits. And I don't know that they're made by anyone today, but they would go out into the Arctic waters, and this protected them from the water. There, while Canadian researchers that said, we've got to figure out what it is about the fur that allows for this. Now, within the hollow structure of the caribou hairs, there is actually honeycomb cellular structure that traps the heat. And he said, even if that fur, those pieces of hair, are pressured and they are flattened, they still hold the heat of the body. And what the Eskimos learned is that the heat gave them an opportunity to wear clothing. They didn't have to wear a whole bunch of clothing because it created an air vacuum around the body that enabled them to withstand cold. There is nothing man-made that equals the real thing, the real fur. So it was quite fascinating to be able to relate back to an experience that I had a number of years ago with a fellow passenger on an air flight that had gone through this experience with an Eskimo, and then to be able to watch this information being talked about on television last night. And they're saying, these people somehow figured this all out. We don't know how they did it, but we haven't figured out how to equal the natural result that the animal fur has been able to produce for them. So lots of times, it is just amazing when you're able to look at what people have learned and you understand why things evolved and the value. And even to this day, there are those that are up in the far north. They'll have wolverine fur that they've either found on a piece of, you know, clothing somewhere. I knew a guy in the Navy that he would have the wolverine around his face because it never froze. Well, that's because these animals live out in these environments, and Mother Nature has enabled them to adapt through the centuries to be able to survive. So the Eskimos observed what was going on around them and utilized it. And I think that's a good lesson for any of us, because if you watch Mother Nature, if you take time, she's one of the greatest teachers. That's what someone who developed Velcro, and I don't recall the man's name right at the moment, but that's something that he discovered. And that's how Velcro came about. We all can learn from nature. So don't ever be afraid to talk to people and ask questions about what they do, what their interests are. You'll find that you get an education so many times that you might never, ever find in a book, because they're out living life and experiencing life and sharing their knowledge. So if any of you know of any cultures, whether it's Native American, Eskimo, I don't care what that culture is, try to have a record of it. If you've got relatives or environments that you find yourself in, try to make a documentation of what the older individuals share with you, because many times they have a knowledge that is beyond what we can possibly know because we're not living the way they were. But just like these Canadian researchers found, there was a great deal of logic behind the choices of these people. And, of course, today their world is dramatically different, and it is changing as all of our worlds change with technology, weather changes, and, you know, this isn't the only time it's happened on this planet. It's happened many, many times before. This is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. Hey, tomorrow we're going to be talking about power animal meditations. Tell your friends, join us right here at bbsradio.com. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have a fabulous day. We'll be back here, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.